When Craig Sherborne was growing up, he thought of his mum as heels because she was always wearing them. Whether serving drinks at the family pub or accompanying Craig on a school outing to the local vegetable cannery. His dad he thought of as Winks, for his way of saying, just between you and me, son, with a blink of one eye. Craig would get that wink when they were at the horses together, or when his mum had got into one of her moods and was ranting at the customers or at the neighbours. In their country town in the North Island of New Zealand, the Sherborne family had a flash Mercedes, maroon with white upholstery. When they moved to Sydney looking for a more glamorous life, the Mercedes was replaced by another maroon car, this one a Tirana. Or as heels like to think of it, a Tirana Mercedes. And the family told each other that after all, that Tirana did look exactly like their old Mercedes. For many years, Craig was a journalist, before quitting to write his own stories full-time. His latest book is a novel called Off the Record. Hi, Craig.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What do you remember about that Tirana Mercedes?
It smelled of my mother's perfume, because she would put on so much perfume. And if I was sitting in the back seat, I'm quite sure I'm going to die of some, you know, lung cancer, not from smoking, but from perfume, because it was just filled the car, and it seeped into the upholstery. That's what I remember about it.
Do you remember what brand she wore?
A VO5, which was the hairspray. That was the strongest bit. And then she had some Chanel, and then there was Max Factor, and a lot of brand names here for the ABC, and then a lot of Max Factor powders and lotions and lipsticks and colourings for the eyes. In the way women in the 70s did, young girls are kind of bringing it back a bit, I find. Well, I've got two stepdaughters, they certainly are.
What you're describing sounds a bit like a toxic cocktail. I'm not surprised.
It was very toxic, I actually used to get car sick, and I get car sick anyway, but if I'm sitting in the back, but I used to, you know, you'd be between Coogee and Ramick, and I'd have to say, can you just stop the car and then chuck up into the gutter on occasions. It was pretty powerful. And that, and my father had Brill Cream, and he had other kind of a lotion for his face that I used to have as well.
Like an eau de cologne?
Kind of like an eau de cologne, but it was more an antiseptic, you know, for shaving cuts. And it was quite powerful. And I used to use that when I started shaving. And when you start shaving, you know, you end up just cutting your face to pieces as a boy. And I started shaving before I needed to, because I wanted to grow up fast and be an adult. And so there was a lot of blood on the floor.
But everyone smelt
Everybody
clean.
Smelt wonderful, actually, I guess. But there were no human smells. It was almost as if human smells were to be eradicated, and they represented a kind of working man and women's way of life. And so you had to put on as much antiperspirant as possible and as much perfume, you know, Brill Cream, and you've got to look, you were dressed to the nines, you know, even when you were doing nothing, everybody was so well dressed.
Well, what sort of things do you remember your mum wearing?
Oh, there was nothing kind of muumuus, big orange ones and things like that, and hair up in a beehive, long dangly earrings of all kinds of colours and shapes, and they all glittered. And there were pantsuits. Yeah, and then my mother had quite big feet for a woman. She'd kill me. She was alive for saying that, but she had big man's feet. So she couldn't really get into high heels. She'd sort of slip into these, I don't know, slip-ons, she would call them, and a pantsuit that would, you know, there were no natural fibres. It was all synthetic. So everybody just sweated. And you know, you had your safari suit, of course, or my father used to wear, you know, very beautiful woolen suits. But, and it was Sydney when I was a teenager, and it was humid. And so everybody sweated, and if you had any synthetics on, you just looked wet. And that's what I remember. So you had to put on a lot of perfume.
Between the synthetics and the perfume, you wouldn't want to be around too many naked flames, or the whole Sherborne family could have just gone up.
Well, there were a lot of naked flames because everybody smoked. You know, the only person who didn't was my father, and he didn't drink either. He was a teetotaler most of the time. He was a publican, which is one of his early businesses, but He was one of those publicans who didn't drink, quite rare. He thought that was a trap.
Hadn't had a problem with alcohol.
Actually a good point, because often you hear that with Americans particularly, I don't drink. I said, why? Are you an alcoholic? He'd never been attracted to it. And he saw it as a trap for a publican to be a drinker, because you drank the profits.
Where was the pub that your dad ran when you were a kid?
Well, before I was born, they lived in a place called Hawera in New Zealand, because they were New Zealanders. And then I was born in Sydney, where my parents were over racing a horse in Sydney, ripped from the wound untimely, and on a trip over here. And then we went back to a place called Hastings, which I've always called... in my books, when I've ever written about it, I call heritage, because it's kind of Hastings. You know, there's a Hastings in Victoria. I suppose there's a Hastings in everywhere in the world, in the Western world anyway. But I just called it heritage. But it was a pub on the corner of the street opposite the big clock tower, and the train ran through the middle of the street. And it was a very profitable business, but it was pretty rough. I mean, it was a pretty tough work. I don't know what it's like now, but it was a pretty tough working class town back then, and we lived atop of the bar, various bars, public and private, in an apartment, and all you heard were just the fights and the yelling and everybody getting drunk. And my father, this is pre-security guard days, so it was my father and one of his colleagues were the bouncers, and put the hand on the bar, over the bar. And he was pretty handy. He was he wasn't big, but he was certainly, he was quick with his fist, and if he needed to be. And my mother had a mouth, she would order people out, and if they wouldn't go, say, Bert was my father's name, Bert, and even if they were really big guys, there's a lot of big Polynesian Maori guys, you see them playing football. My father was half their size, so.
So did you ever see him get in a fight?
Oh, yes. Oh, hell yes. I saw him fighting... always in defence of, or trying to give someone the bum's rush. And if someone's,
what does that mean?
Well, you grab them by the collar and you grab them by the back of their pants, and you just, it's actually quite disarming. And then you just run them to the door and then throw them out and then try and close the door behind them. And, there was one occasion I remember somebody came at him with a chain. It was a bikie gang had got into the pub, and they're very difficult to throw out, and the cops wouldn't come. And so him and one of his guys who was who's a barman, who worked as a bouncer, over they went, hand on the bar, over they went, and trying to get rid of them. And the guy just came back in with a chain and started whacking away at a chain.
Sounds terrifying. So you were witnessing?
Yeah,
that.
But I used to stand at the top of the stairs, because there were no security in those days. So children weren't protected in the way that. So I think overweened now. You were just, this is the way life was, kid. So get out of the way, watch it, and learn. And I guess I was expected to go into the business, so I was given a full education.
And what happened with the guy who came back with the chain?
Oh, Dad dealt with him, but got him out. But there was another time he got attacked with a knife. And one time the local police officer had come and Dad accidentally hit him and knocked him out, and during a brawl, because he just he didn't the police officer on the one occasion they actually arrived was trying to help, and Dad didn't know. He just turned around and whacked him one and knocked him out, he got out of that trouble by quite a few free beers. but it was a tough, rough, hard, masculine orientated world where a young boy such as myself, who was quite, strangely enough, although I'm quite large now, was quite effete and given to poetry, way before my years. I couldn't understand a word, but I loved the music of it. And so to be in that environment and to just be this rather twee, poetic sort, it was so incongruous. But it was good. It gave me a lot of material.
Your mum sent you, Craig, to a Mrs. Daly. What was that for?
Well, I had a stutter, and it was actually an elocution. This is this is back in the late 60s, so this would be, you know, before you had speech therapists and things like that. But I had a terrible stutter, and whenever I got worked up or upset, I would. I also had huge ears. I still do, but they were like Mr. Spock ears. So I was ripe for being mocked at school and was merciless. But I used to sort of stutter, and I also had an accent which tore the bottom of my lip off and had to be stitched back on. I was pushed down the stairs by a boy, and I just stuttered, and it was a kind of, I guess it was a bit of a nervous tic. So we went to this elocution teacher, and it was kind of a way, they thought, well, the way to get around the stutter is to make you sound posh. And I used to, that was amazing, because she used to have a little bird that she poked with her fingernail, this little parody thing, and I would have to read poems, you know.
To the bird?
Well, no, I would have to just read. She would give me these poems. I've still got them. I've still got this book with all these poems in them that I had to read, and she would write them out in pencil and for me, and, you know, John Masefield stuff. I must go down to the sea again, to the lonely sea and the sky, and all I want is a tall ship and a star to steer her by. But I would be saying, I must go down to the, you know, again into the lonely sea, and I'd be all over the place. And it didn't really work. And one day I was riding my bike and I didn't really want to go because I just hated it. I was so embarrassed by it. And my little elocution case, which is a leather case, which I still got caught in the spokes of the wheels, and I went flying off and broke the bike, broke the case, pretty much broke my skull, but still stuttered. And then one day, being brought up in a pub, I used to sort of, you know, you get curious, what's alcohol? And I'm only a boy, I must have been not even 10. So I started to drink the dregs of the whiskey glasses.
What, just secretively?
So you used to find them, you know, and they had telephone booths in the pub in those days, and people would go in there and they'd have a telephone call, and then they'd put their, you know, they'd put their glass of whiskey down or whatever, and I'd be helping collect the glasses, you know, out of there, and I'd just, oh, what's that? Smells, it's whiskey, you know. And one day I got quite drunk. And
your parents didn't know what you were doing?
No. I mean, I didn't do it all the time. I remember this one occasion I got really quite drunk, and I went up into this landing in the bottle store and fell and was sort of knocked out. And my parents arrived thinking that I was dead, and they sort of bent down and went, he's drunk. And I was reeked of whiskey. But anyway, curiously, the stutter, and I don't know whether this is just coincidence or linked, but the stutter kind of went. It just went. I still had a bit of a lisp, and I still have now, but it just sort of went.
After you sobered up?
I didn't have it anymore, anywhere near the same degree, and it just disappeared.
So not Mrs. Daly, just
whiskey. Mrs. Daly had nothing to do with it, God bless her. But she did help me with the love of language, the love of poetry, because even though these were not necessarily the greatest poems to be reading in the world, they were still lovely musical bits of language.
You also left-handed as a kid. How did they deal with that?
Well, there used to be this thing, some families still have this, almost like a superstition, that people who were left-handed, there's something wrong with them, and that they were going to end up being bad eggs. It's not true. I ended up a bad egg, and I'm right-handed now. But the left hand seemed to symbolise almost something like being a devil. So my mother said, you've got to be right-handed. So she used to tie string to my fingers so that when I went to write left-handed, I would see the string and then would go and write right-handed, and that over time I would just learn to write with my right hand. And it worked. And I guess whatever it is in the brain that decides what hand you're going to write with switched, and I learned, and I write with my right hand. But I still, like, if I do anything sporty, which I don't, like a cricket bat or tennis ball or whatever, hitting a tennis ball, I'm left-handed still, but right-handed for writing.
So
left-handed for drawing.
So it was, you knew what was expected, and you
did it. I was obedient, you know. I mean, I was an only child with two parents whom I adored and thought were gods, and if they told me it was bad to be left-handed and it was sinful, I was going to be right-handed, whether it killed me.
What was a good day like in your household, Craig, at the pub? What was a happy day?
If the horses were winning. My parents came in this, grew up in this sort of area when horse racing was the popular activity. It's not now, and it's reviled in some quarters, but in those days it was a great, if you had a bit of dough, that's where you went to enjoy yourself, socialise, make some money, gamble, you know, drink. It was hedonistic, and it was wonderful, and I loved it, you know, and everybody looked great, and they smelt over great. And and it was sort of sexual, just not only the horses, because the horses are, I still love horses, and they're beautiful, sensual creatures to look at, muscly, and you know, their genitalia exposed and all that, but the human beings, they were flirtatious, and they were, you know, there was money, there was grog, and they were always almost on the verge of having an affair without having one, because they were still believed in certain pieties, you know, infidelities. But they were they weren't wild. It wasn't a wild environment, but it was just a slightly sleazy one, and I loved it.
What do you remember your mum and dad wearing to the races if they were part of that environment? How dressed up would they have got?
Oh, seriously. I mean, it was they were normally extremely well-dressed, but out came the pearls or the diamonds and the diamond rings for, you know, for mother, and then painting on the lipstick, and I used to help her, you know, get dressed and, you know, do up her necklaces and that sort of thing, and she would always seek an appraisal from my father and me on how she looked. And she always looked pretty good, a very big woman, almost 6 foot, which is unusual, you know, back then. So she was very striking, becoming a little bit podgy because she was middle-aged, but managing still to slide into that
zip
dress
that
that's a bit too nice. That, you know, get there behind her. Okay, we're going to get this damn thing up if it kills you, you know. And then my father would be just magnificent in a three-piece suit, you know, shiny shoes that you could see your face in, binoculars, which I still have, with a leather strap that he tied in a bow and with hook over his forearm, and smelt beautiful cologne, clean-shaven, perfectly clean-shaven. I used to get his cast-offs, because I was like 6 foot by the time I was 13, and Dad was only about 5'9". So, you know, from the earliest day, I got his cast offs like I was his younger brother or something. So I would wear these, by then, rather too small sports jackets that he would have, you know, and we would go to the races, and I would be in the sports jacket, which my school sergeant, we had a sergeant at the school, the high school I went to, he used to go to the races, and he saw me walking into the members area one day, and he was Scottish, and he said, Sherwin, where the hell did you get that jacket, lad? I went, it's my father's, and he goes, oh, Jesus, that means you must be running out of money. Can you afford to send you to school? And I used to give him some tips, and I didn't get expelled for a couple of things, probably because I gave him some good tips. You know, this is going to win today.
So, yeah. So your mum and dad were running this hotel in New Zealand when you were a kid, and it sounds like it was doing well. Why did they move? Why did they leave?
Because they were upwardly mobile. I mean, aspirational, and it was seen to be, well, we've done that. We've done okay in business here, but it's nothing if we, you know, it's like going to Hollywood. You know, we want to go, you know, if you're an actor or something, we want to go to Hollywood or to the West End in London. So their equivalent was going to Sydney, which they thought was, New Zealanders called it Siders, and they thought it was just the most glamorous place and beautiful place in the world with that harbour, and they wanted to be part of it. And they thought, you know, having a you know, only child, and you don't want to have him in this rough environment because, you know, he might end up. I think they had one family friend whose son had grown up to be involved in a biker gang and had been killed, and they didn't want that for me. So off we went to Sydney, sold up, and you know, went to the white trash part of Vaucluse in Sydney, Diamond Bay. Sorry, folks, if you live in Diamond Bay, but that's what we referred to it sort of back then, you know.
How old were you when you moved?
I was 12. I went to Ramick North Primary School when I was 12.
And were you excited to come here?
But it was so, it was, you know, I was excited, the wrong word. I thought it was an adventure, but I just did whatever they wanted me to do, you know, and I just thought it was normal because they were always talking about it, and we're always thinking that it's this, well, like people would speak of Paris or something, you know, or London. They just thought it was the capital of the world, and they wanted to be there. So I thought, this is good, I'll go with that. And then arrived there with no friends, you know, quite shy, quite effete and poetic. And
in your dad's old jackets.
In my dad's old jackets, yeah.
They didn't want you to have that kind of rough life in the pub.
None.
Certainly didn't want you in a bikie gang. What did they want for you at that age? What were they hoping you'd grow up into?
I don't know. Just to be successful, to make money, to have social prestige, and you know, it's not uncommon. You know, I mean, this still goes on a lot today. And but they were particularly insistent that I do it. They wanted, I don't know, to be a prime minister or something. They wanted me to go into business. Because it make money, make a lot of money.
Was it the kind of case that they had left their origins behind,
yes,
and they
yes.
wanted you to leapfrog
yeah,
further ahead
yeah.
again?
Yeah, and then you know, if I had children, then they would maybe leapfrog again. You know, so it was that whole aspirational ladder, and they were on it, and they were, you know, they were middle aged by then. They had me quite late in life. They got married quite late in life. Most people got married in their teens or 20s. They were well into their late 30s before I came along, early in 40. So they were middle-aged and they were getting a bit tired, but they wanted one big fling at a big business in Sydney, so they did that. And then that really didn't work out that well.
What sort of business did they try to get into?
It was a liquor store in Rose Bay, and it didn't work out that well, so they sold it and then bought a business back in New Zealand. We lived in Sydney, a farm.
When you upped and moved to Sydney, how did the races here at Randwick, how did they compare to the racetracks and the racing you'd been a part of in New Zealand?
It was completely, being out in bush and suddenly going into, you're rubbing shoulders with prime ministers. You know, I saw Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser when I was a kid at the races, and you never thought you would ever see those people just wandering around, socialising, shaking
hands.
How
did your dad respond to seeing those politicians?
Well, he was Malcolm Fraser. He pretended that he was a mate and that he was going to introduce me to him. He was great at tall stories. So he came up with this idea that somehow he knew Mel. I'd come over, son, I'll introduce you to Big Mel. Okay, Mel, come over here. And this is my son. And, of course, you know, Malcolm Fraser was completely amazed by this and just wanted to get away, and with Dad pretending that he was with the set, you know,
and wanting to show to you
these are the people, this is how blokes deal with blokes, and this is how you deal with people in power, because we're actually now part of that set. Of course they weren't at all. It was a joke, but it was amusing. It stuck out of my memory, and I knew by then that he was just going a little bit too far, and so I started to be a little bit disrespectful towards him, and saying, you know, come on, this is really embarrassing now, you know, which I think rather shocked him, because I think he thought he was going to be able to call me like this for the rest of my life.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky. ABC Radio.
Craig, you were describing your family moved to Sydney for a kind of a more glamorous life, bigger opportunities. Your dad and mum were trying to run a liquor business, and you were sent to a private school.
Yes.
What kind of fit was that school for you?
Oh, it was hopeless. I would much rather have stayed in primary school for the rest of my life. It was kind of lovely at primary school, but it was, it was a boys' school, and it was pretty feral. You were there was a great deal of snobbery, but it was kind of violent. It was a little, we played rugby. I was a reasonably good rugby player, and we used to have these things such as you take the train out to the regatta, these rowing regattas, and it was all about school, being winning the school, winning team, being part of the team. And they were just violent inter-school brawls. I remember you got on each This is going from Sydney out to Nepean, getting on the train, and each school would be in one carriage, and the idea was to get into the other carriage and try and beat up one of the other guys, and then try and drag them off the train, to either strip them and then, you know, take their clothes off and then throw them off the train when the train stopped. Hopefully the train had stopped. But I can remember, you know, the chains going around between the doors to try and stop the other school from breaking in to our carriage. And it was really quite terrifying, because you did think, well, that they might break in, open the doors, there'd be a fight, you lose, and out you go through the door.
Was it that?
Through the door onto the rail tracks.
Was it the kind of scenario where you felt, as a teenager, you either had to join in or you'd be the target?
Well, you were fighting for your life, so you had to kind of join in. But I got off okay. I was always, you know, reasonably large, and I wasn't one of the ones who was, I guess our school was the bully, the bulliest of the bullies.
Well, an accolade.
The people on the carriage, and that we sort of won a lot of those things, a lot of those confrontations. Of course, you joined in, because you wanted to be one of the crowd. Being left out or being a loner is... Yeah, I was over being a loner, being an only child by then. I really wanted to fit in, and so I got involved in that. Not with to any expert degree. There were people who were much bigger, stronger, and you know, terrible bullies who were good at that stuff. But you know, you wanted to be seen, to be there doing it. Look at me, I'm helping. And of course, you're not really helping, you're probably getting in the way.
Did you have kids that you connected with as well? Were there friends
in
that school?
Yes, there were. And we had friends there. It's funny, you know, I'm the only person I know who doesn't have any relationships with the friends he went to school with.
What about primary school?
Primary school in New Zealand, I went to in New Zealand, I got contacted by a guy when I published my novel, The Amateur Science of Love, and he'd read some of my stuff, and he sent me an email through my publisher and said, "Hi, Craig, you're right, and how good? It's good. I'm a High Court judge." It's true. And so he's a High Court judge in New Zealand. He's done well. Good for him.
They're super, ain't nothing on the writers, Craig.
Oh, I know. Yeah, well, he gets to wear a red robe, which would be nice.
Did you used to have any kids from school over to your house? You said you lived in the white trash part of Vaucluse.
Yeah, they used to, but it was really, I was a bit embarrassed by it, because a lot of these people, these kids lived in really serious mansions, you know, and I used to like to go to their place. And when they came to my place, it was a bit dowdy, you know, and a bit small, and a nice view over Diamond Bay, but I thought, I'd rather we went to their place.
Were you embarrassed by your mum and dad?
I was, because they were different sort of parents, I suppose. My mother was eccentric by this stage, and she was a bit of a snob. She was a real snob. And so she would, she would over-fuss and pretend that she was bigger than she was in the social world. And she couldn't help herself. She would do it. And
well, what sort of things would she say or do to...
Well, she would say, well, of course, we're going out, you know, to a lovely, you know, party at Point Piper on Saturday. Will your parents be there? Well, tell them, you know, it would be a shame if they're not, that we're going to the races beforehand, and we've got a horse running in the fifth, but coming to training, it absolutely got a good chance. And then, as I say, we're off to Point Piper to this, I think it's a rather shabby house they've got, but it has got a nice pool. But if you ask me, they should get rid of those shrubs and actually put in some nice pebbles or scoria. And you get the picture.
you do that well, you remember that well. Did you take on some of those behaviours yourself? Did you find yourself talking in that way to other kids?
I think so. I certainly have. I mean, I see the fun in it, and I know it's sending her up. I've just sent her up then, and sending myself up when I do it. But it was so important to her to be like that, and it was so ingrained, and the pretension, which runs through, vanity and pretension run through everything I've ever written, particularly in my new book, Pretension. It left such a mark on me that, and I am her son, and her DNA courses through, you know, my little liquid bits inside me. Yeah.
You say that that apartment, that flat, had a view over the ocean, over the gully, and there was one Sunday morning where you saw something really awful from that window. Yeah. What happened?
Well, we had a very, very good view of the ocean, and part of that Diamond Bay, Rosa Gully area, there was this, this still might be, I haven't been there for years, this area which was just a cliff face and a grassy area where people used to walk their dogs. And I was just looking over the balcony one day, and there was a boy, and I didn't know him, I'd seen him around, but he was playing with his little dog and throwing a ball, and he threw it towards the cliff face, and the ball went over the cliff face, and the dog went over after the ball, and the boy went over after the dog, and it straight down onto rocks. And
you saw that?
Yeah, and then the fireys arrived, police arrived, ambulance arrived, and they winched him up in a gurney covered in plastic. And I was standing there and, you know, talking to the authorities, saying what I'd seen. And there were, by now, other people were standing around. And then as they got him up, this was a couple of hours later, they pulled back the plastic blanket, or the plastic covering, and I saw his face, and it was the face the same age as mine, dead. And I'd never seen a dead body. I'd seen lots of dead animals, but not seen a dead body. And it was like looking at your own self. You know. It's quite bracing. It makes you get quite serious about life, you know, for a little while anyway. There, but for, you know, the grace of not having a dog, could go me, you know.
Had you thought much about death?
I think you do. If you have anything to do with, if you read and if you love novels and poems, and they're quite morbid, you know, particularly if you start reading Shakespeare, which I did quite young when I didn't understand a word of it, but you understand some of the music and some of the dramatic bits. Somebody's getting stabbed, somebody's dying, somebody's there's a death speech, you know, and they can go on, these death speeches, but they're quite morbid. And the stories, you know, the stories you read in novels, in poems, there's nothing more morbid than from poetry from the Romantic era. They all got that dying fall, and they all died so young, and that, you know.
But they're kind of in love with death. It's kind of, it's
are.
A fantasy. That's very different from actually seeing a dead body.
Seeing it, but I certainly had it for a long time as a kid, as a fantasy. I saw it as, it's one of the bad things literature can teach you is that you can take the death aspect of it, at the glamour of it, and take it into yourself and say, well, this is actually quite a lovely thing to be a poet or to be a novelist, and you drink too much when you die young of consumption, and
it gets you out of all those expectations and responsibilities.
I know, and you'll be famous, and everybody will think of you as being this this terribly romantic figure, famous, and it's just rubbish. But when you're a child and impressionable, there is nothing. I was terribly impressionable, and that stuff really didn't lead me to be quite a morbid, maudlin sort of figure through my teenage years.
But did that change, seeing the boy, do you think? Did it things get a bit realer?
Well, they certainly, it was for a little while, I actually probably made it more intense, because I then could actually put a face to all this death and all this romantic idea of death and dying. I could put a face to it, and at first being confronted, then thought, it's almost, I'm loath to use the word glamour, but I wasn't frightened of it. You know, I was kind of accepting of it in the end.
What was your mum's reaction to that,
oh,
that
put it,
boy?
Oh, put it absolutely disgraceful. How dare anybody die on my backyard, in our backyard? I mean,
you're
honestly,
kidding.
How
really? Is this, are you exaggerating this?
I'm not exaggerating. It's absolutely just God, close the blinds. I just don't want to have anything to think about that sort of thing. We're not here to be witnessing little baby children dying, thank you very much. We're here to, you know, enjoy life.
Your parents then bought a farm back in New Zealand.
Yes.
Tudor Park.
Yes.
Quite a name.
Yeah.
What was it like? What sort of farm?
Well, it was a dairy farm, and it was quite a large one. And it was a good one, a very good farm in the Waikato. But they saw it as being like an estate that I would, like they were Duke and Duchess of this estate, and that I would be this little Lord Fauntleroy, you know, who would ponce about doing a little bit of work here and there, and it would be an estate like they see, like they have in England.
So like landed gentry is how Sherbournes were going to be.
But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that. But my mother, particularly being a fantasist, was that what it was like for her. The reality being that she had to do things such as keep, you know, housework, which she hated, you know, keeping the back doorstep scrub, which was wooden and always full of cow manure and horse manure, and had to do things like such as cook, which she was never much into, but there were people to cook for, staff often to cook for. So it was, but still, it was, you know, it still was an estate in their mind, and there were, you know, there were horses to be had, and we had visitors staying from Australia, and the fantasy was good until I decided that I didn't want to be on a farm in the Waikato in New Zealand. Sorry, I'm going to London. And their dreams were shattered, and I don't think they ever quite recovered from that. I think the disappointment, you know, we all have as adults, lonely breaks in hope that are never repaired. And I think that was the one for them. Yeah, they never forgave me for that.
Did you fight about your decision to go away?
No, we didn't fight. There was no fight. We weren't really fighters. We were bitchy rather than fighting. Fighting is a bit sort of low grade, really. We're bitching and nagging, you know, and complaining and minor recriminations. I just think I saw it in my dad's eyes, a sort of... They were sunken with disappointment, and I felt terribly sorry for him when years later he was dying. I didn't feel sorry for him at the time because I was so, you know, I was in my 21 years old and was full of life and just wanted to go out and explore the world. And so self-centered as you are, can be at that time, the last thing I wanted to do was to care about the feelings of some sort of, you know, podgy-bellied middle-aged man who happens to be my father. And my mother was just, well, you know, typical. Just typical. You know, it's just so predictable, you know. Out of my loins came this child I put everything into, and he's just shattered our dreams.
Ungrateful. Ungrateful.
Typical.
You described your mum at this time of going on something called a ghost train in her head. What did that mean? What does that mean?
I think by this time she was suffering from a, you know, in that particular, she was bored. At that particular time in history, you know, women who were very smart as she was, but who didn't have a university education, if they'd done okay in business, in small business or small to medium business, and they retired, they were then just became housewives, and she was not a housewife. She didn't want to be that. She'd have been born now. She would still be, you know, on boards of companies, and she would have been terrific at that. But as she got bored, and she was still relatively young, you know, in her late 50s, she still had, you know, 30 years, more years to live, she would get ideas into her head about, you know, any minor thing, and they would just get out of control. And it was a kind of depression that became almost violent inside her, and she would, I just thought of it like a ghost train going, you know how you you're tearing through this dark space and there are little demons jumping out at you and you're a kid. And it's all a lot of fun. It wasn't fun for her.
How did she look when she was in that state?
Oh, she would foam at the mouth. Yes, she would foam at the mouth and she would have fingernails would be, you know, like if they, it was like there were claws, you know, and she would be scratching the air and scratching her hair and then it would pass. It was temper, you know, she was had quite a temper. But it was these were just these episodes and then they would go. But
how did you used to see it? Like, were you scared watching that or angry at her? How did it affect you?
It was just normal. I just thought it was kind of normal. I probably, I did think that, well, everyone's like that, aren't they? You know, everyone's like that. My dad had his temperament moments but hers were something else. It was like... I sort of been slightly possessed, and it was none of this was ever talked about because those days you didn't talk about that stuff. Everybody, it was just contained within this little family of three, and we all protected one another, and we would all lie for each other. You know, we would stand up in court and lie for each other with our hand on the Bible, and we were so loyal to each other. So I just, that was that. My dad would say, I was just having, one of the episodes. Worry about it. Yeah, so I didn't. And they got worse and worse as you got older. Mm.
What kind of model do you think your mum and dad gave you of your own relationships when you went off into the world in your 20s and started?
I was probably glad to get away, but I was also desperate to fall in love and, desperate to be with someone, to have a companion, because you really hadn't. I mean, hadn't really formed any attachments with anyone apart from them. And you get into your 20s and 21 and you haven't done that, you really want to. So, the first person you see, you fall passionately in love with.
And that's what happened to you?
That's exactly what I did. Passionately, madly in love with, without having any of the emotional facility to deal with the complications that can bring.
And your first big love affair had a whole lot of extra complication in terms
of
illness.
Pretty soon afterwards.
Yeah, what happened?
Oh, my wife got breast cancer. She was 9 years older than me, but she, I would have been 28, at that stage, and she got them, and she got it, and relationship was starting to strain, and we were, probably in normal circumstances, we would have split up as people do. You have your first big love. I wasn't her first big love, but she was mine. And but of course you can't in that circumstances because she had quite aggressive breast cancer, mastectomy, chemotherapy, and we stuck it out for another 10 years until I just felt like worn down like a stub of a pencil and felt that I was wasted a lot of years of my life and didn't want to do it anymore and fell in love with someone else and left. Which is the saddest 10 years and the saddest period I can imagine of life. That had nothing to do with my parents. It was you can't prepare anyone for that, I don't think. Yeah.
Was there a lot of guilt for you when you left that marriage?
It took fair while to go. But, guilt... guilt withers, it's very, very bright and powerful in your body and in your mind, but then it just kind of withers and you get on with life and new life springs up and you have other responsibilities. You have work out, you have a family, new family, you have to provide for and look after I don't like the idea of role models. I never understand the whole concept. To me, this is a mad, my idea of being a role model, I took my oldest stepdaughter to the races and said, "Smell that, darling? That's the smell of sin." So, she's turned out terrifically. And so I think I don't go with this whole role model business.
That first relationship, though, you've written about this.
Yeah.
You broke up. Happens all the time.
Yes.
But it didn't end there. There is this strange coda to that relationship. What happened after you hadn't heard or seen from your first wife for a long time, and then you got a call from a friend?
I got a call from a friend to say she died. And what do you do? You know, I mean, I hadn't been contacted by anybody except a friend who wasn't great friends with Alex, my first wife. But just said, "Did you know?" And I went, "No, I didn't know." And I was utterly, you know, not shocked, but you know, oh hell. So it brought back a lot of stuff, and I eventually ended up writing about it, as one would if you're a writer. That's what you kind of do. Yeah.
She made a request about her funeral.
Well, that I not be there, apparently. Yes.
How did you take that, or make sense?
I understood.
Of that?
Perfectly reasonable. Yeah, perfectly reasonable. And it was just a friend told me, I want you there. And I presume that it had come from her directly or whatever, and that's fine. Absolutely reasonable.
What about your mum and dad's funerals? They've both passed away.
No, they were pretty tragic. Yeah, well, Dad died in 2004 and Mum in 2009, and Mum by that stage had quite advanced dementia, and she died in Queensland in a nursing home, and Dad died in Queensland too. They were living there, been living there for a few years. And it reminded me, and I've always thought that the closer you get to reality in writing about life, the closer you get to reality, the more you realise the farce in reality. And his death was one of the funniest, horriblest days of my life. I was in tears, of course, holding his hand as he had the death rattle. And this person just came in the room I'd never seen before, this elderly guy, perfectly well-dressed, wore socks in the Queensland way. And sat and just stood there and then stood in the doorway and said, "Hello." And I went, "Sorry, who are you? My father's dying. He's got about 2 minutes to live. Sorry. Do you mind leaving us in peace?" And he said, "Oh, no problem. I'll just sit here and watch."
What?
No. And this guy just sat there and wanted to watch. And I had to then say quite aggressively, "Get out now." So in getting him out, I realised my mum had gone missing because she'd had dementia. She'd gone missing in this hospice, and I'm trying to find her, and she's running around saying hello to everybody, being all sort of cheerful, going into the rooms where all these very sick people are, saying, "Hello, how are you?" And I came back, and my dad had died.
Craig, that's terrible.
And I was so angry, ferociously angry, and this guy had, you know, interrupted this profound moment. And it was the most profound moment. I felt utterly as though, I don't know if we have a soul, but if it is, and there is this mass, this physical mass called a soul in us, I felt as though it had been wrenched right out. And at that moment when I should have been there and while he took his last breath, he died alone.
Was that man still there in the room when you got back?
No, he was wandering down the hallway, I guess, to go and interrupt some other death.
Can you laugh about that? It's like farce.
Well,
how do you?
Well, it is farce, isn't it? I mean, because it's farcical. How can? It's almost like there's a cruel god somewhere poking a stick at us, going, just at that time when, you know, just like the cruel kid and poking a stick at a lizard to see if it'll bite. I often think, well, maybe that's what's going on here, but my father would have laughed.
Craig Sherborne, who can take the most dastardly, cringeworthy elements of life and make us laugh about them. Thank you for being my guest on Conversations.
You're very welcome.
Craig's latest book is called Off the Record. Don't forget, you can listen to Conversations anytime, anywhere on the ABC Listen app. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.